There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it, rip it.
All right, welcome to the Member Guest Podcast. This is Andy. I'm going to be hosting tonight's episode. Very special guest tonight, fellow St. Albans Bulldog, my buddy Ken G. Ken, thanks so much for joining, man. I really glad to have you on. So tonight's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about some stuff that we've been excited to dig into. Ken has a very interesting, unique background. I'll share a couple minutes of our origin story. I think we met in, was it seventh grade, Ken? Yeah, we met in seventh grade, played sports together, were buddies in high school. And Ken has gone on to do some extremely cool stuff with his career. He is working in golf, doing a lot of other things as well, but I will probably not do it justice. So why don't you kick us off, Ken, and give us a little bit of your background and how you find yourself being interviewed on such a prestigious golf podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I'll spare you guys my life story. I'll try to stick with the golf bits. So why I might be interesting on this specific podcast is my main work is in sports analytics. So the goal of our company is to help athletes and teams improve their performance by analyzing the data collected on them. Some of the athletes and teams we get to work with are pretty relevant in the golf space. So we do the analytics for the U.S. Ryder Cup team, as well as the President's Cup team. We also do some stuff in basketball and things along those lines. So obviously, I probably have a little bit of a different perspective on this game that we all know and love, more from a numbers and a quantitative side. Fortunately, I also did play a little bit of golf myself, and I at least have some chops, not very impressive chops, but I was able to pivot my love for the game, my understanding of the analytics and things that helped me personally into a career where we're hoping to help professional golfers and teams maximize on their performance. So if you'd like a little bit more backstory all the way back from when me and Andy were kicking it around in seventh grade, happy to dive in there, or we can keep it going.
You take one, I mean, look, would be get great. Again, I bet our audience would love to hear what young Andy was like.
Well, yep. some would say, Ken, some would say that one could credit Ken's career and success to a potential position change for me. I mean, I don't know. You know, Ken, it's up to you to decide that.
Yeah. So, I think that there's some credit due there. So, some backstory. Andy and I both played baseball. Andy is, or was, maybe still is, I don't know, a phenomenal baseball player. If you saw one of my more recent YouTube videos, I kind of still got it in that department. But you know, we were both competing for the position of catcher. Our junior year, I think it's fair to say we both split time. And going into our senior year, I said, enough of this. I'm going to go play golf instead. I just didn't want to have to compete with Andy. He was too good a guy, too good a ball player. a lot of that decision is sort of a microcosm for how I view golf in general. So baseball in that environment, it's a team sport. There's also other things that are factors in if you play or not that you are not responsible for. I could, in theory, play a better game than Andy does, have more consistency over a season, and I could still not necessarily win a starting job or whatever that might be. Like, there's someone that makes those decisions for you. I'm not saying that's the case by any means, but that's something that really... that I really struggled with. I love the objectivity of golf. I could go out, I could shoot a number, doesn't matter what it looked like. If my number on the scorecard was lower than your number on the scorecard, I was the better golfer that day. And that's something I really relished and something I really dove into as I was playing golf my senior year of high school, then eventually in college, and then trying to play professionally, is that I am in complete control. I am in the driver's seat of what happens with the outcomes. And there's nothing anyone else can do to save me. There's nobody, there's, you know, Andy isn't there hitting behind me to drive in the runs after I struck out or something along those lines. And to me, that immense pressure on myself and that control of the outcomes is something I really relished. And I don't know if there are too many sports like that, you know, individual sports, I guess, to be fair, they're all like that, but golf to me just felt a little different. And that's what one of the early things that made me fall in love with the game.
So it's very, very interesting because when I think about it, you, your approach is very analytical. So I'm curious, like, have you always had this analytical mind where, like, even when you're that age, that the stats and consistency and those types of things played into your approach? Or is this something that you developed later in life that just kind of became a passion? Or have you always been that way?
I definitely developed it later in life. I think Andy, he might not know this, but we were always battling for the bottom half of the academic ladder. Like, at best, I was like a 2.0 student in high school. You know, not to get too personal, I had some. I can if you want. I've talked about it before, but I had some personal stuff happen my junior year of college. I had a big perspective shift, and I really started to realize that there was value in education and learning. And I took an economics course, and it blew the scalp off my head. I realized that I could understand the world, a world that was very complex, with a lot of things happening through numbers and graphs. And I realized, hey, could I apply this to my golf game? So when I was in college, my first 3 years, I didn't play. I went with the intention of walking on at Furman University, and I didn't exactly see eye to eye with the coach. They had just redone all the greens, and it was like hitting into a parking lot. So it was impossible, in my personal opinion, and nobody did, to hit the scoring threshold that the coach had set for making the team. So I went. I eventually transferred to Towson, also a D1 school, and finished my career there. But I felt like I was behind. I felt like I was doing everything I should be doing, lifting, practicing, maybe partying a little too much. But at the time, I didn't see that as a detriment. And the one place I found an advantage was analyzing my stats. I would do really rudimentary stuff. I'd look at my variance on different hole types. I'd look at the different parts of my game, my driving, my approaches, my chipping, and my putting. And I'd see, hey, where could I make the greatest improvement compared to the other areas of my game? It turned out I was crooked with the driver, and straightening that out was really important to me, and it helped me improve a lot. So I saw immediately in golf that analytics could have value, and that kickstarted this whole other cascade of other ways analytics were valuable in my life. I mean, I fell in love with it. It started with my game, and then I started analyzing the games of professionals. I fell in love with DraftKings, with daily fantasy sports. I actually ended up, after I quit playing professional golf, I went and interned at DraftKings for a little bit. And the analytics just seemed to follow me. And the experience applying it to myself and then evaluating professional athletes' games, it eventually led to this unique spot where I could eventually, with my team, help making recommendations or help to understand how the game at the highest level could be played at an even more advanced level through all the data that's collected.
And Ken, when you say you're doing... Oh, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, how did you see immediately, like with your game, where did you see the biggest impact? Like, did you start keeping your stats or...
I did. There was, in college, there was this program that is free to all college golfers. I think it's called Golf Stat. And you could log your practice rounds, all the tournament rounds were logged. And I was like the only one using it. Nobody wanted to record their stats. And I just started doing it. I started exporting it to an Excel sheet. I started analyzing my par 5 scoring, my par 4 scoring, my par 3 scoring. Something as simple as that, I was realizing, like, I hit it pretty far for an average college golfer. Why am I not playing better on par 5s? Where am I losing shots? And just that awareness and that analysis helped me really focus on areas I could improve my game. So something in economics that I really latched onto was this marginal return. So a marginal return is basically the more you do something, the less better at it you get. So let's take like Bryson DeChambeau. If he's ripping drivers all the time, there's probably some threshold where getting a lot of work goes into getting just a little bit better at driving the golf ball. That same amount of work put into chipping, which generally is historically an area where he struggled, could create massive gains in chipping that would be more in terms of strokes than he would gain driving from that same amount of effort. So I really got into this idea of how do I maximize the scoring benefits with the least amount of effort put in. And that was a huge flywheel for me, almost in everything I do. I think of the entire world in that same frame.
That's fascinating. So you just found that basically like having access to the data and kind of taking an inventory of your game allowed you to isolate the areas where you could reap outsized rewards from focusing on them. So in some ways, it's almost like you got more efficient as a player.
Precisely.
I assume you started practicing those things and saw those gains. And so did it immediately change like what you were practicing and working on in your game?
Yeah, I would take that stuff to my coach. At the time, I was working with this guy, Bernie Najjar, out of Case Valley. He's a great coach. Probably to that point, every coach I'd ever went to, I thought was a complete buffoon. You know, there just wasn't anything that would stick to me. It would always be like, feel like you're here, you know, get into this motion. And it wasn't quantitative enough. It wasn't like, if you do this, this follows, and this is the pattern that it falls into. It was always just do this because I'm the golf coach and you should be doing it, not why am I doing this? There wasn't this cascade of events that made sense. So I would, yeah, directly work with my coach and say, hey, this is an issue I'm having. I'm missing exactly 50% of my shots right and 50% of my shots left.
I'm sure he was like weirded out that you knew that.
I mean, at the time,
how do you know that?
Yeah, at the time it was weird, but he was also one of the, you know, every coach will ever, even back then, was telling you to keep the stats. It was just that nobody would, you know, I mean, it's one of these things where that little extra effort, I think, made me from probably a bad college golfer to a kind of average college golfer, which for me was a long way to go.
Well, the reduction of diminishing returns, you just maximize your growth, right? By practicing the right things. So it made you into a better player than what traditional practice probably would have got you to. Is that what you're trying to say? I'm just trying to make sure I'm relaying it properly.
No, that's precisely it. You know, I would go as a kid, I would just grind drivers on the range, just try and hit it as far as like, that would be a practice session. I'd go hit 100 drivers, like 12, 7 irons, and then I'd go maybe a couple putts and then I'd go play. And that probably wasn't the best way to do it in hindsight, but it was also probably a lot more fun to practice that way. So you have to find that balance as well too.
So now you've grown, you've learned all of these things, you've utilized these skill sets for yourself to get better in golf. How, like, where was the transition from yourself into a professional or at what point were you like, I can maximize this and utilize this at DraftKings or wherever you were deciding to go to?
Yeah. So I was trying to play a bunch of the DraftKings competitions just right after I went, I played in Florida for 6 months, made no money, lost actually a bunch of money as you can imagine, just money games, also tournament expenses, whatever it might be. And I said, this is enough. This is not fun. I'm having more fun doing daily fantasy. I'm actually losing less money. I was about breaking even in daily fantasy on the golf side then. I might as well go back to school, try to learn a trade. Another economics principle that I learned a lot about is opportunity cost, right? So I realized if I was down there, if I was playing golf, let's say I did it for 3 years. And if I was just making money after 3 years, what are my career options going forward? I could do essentially a couple of things. I mean, very common to go into real estate, sell insurance, those types of careers. Great careers, but not something I was particularly interested in. I realized if I went down this road, I probably wouldn't have as many of the things that I really relished in a career as if I just stuck with it and tried it. And some people might say, oh, you gave up on your dreams, whatever it might be. I was being an extreme realist and with my own capabilities on that front. So I actually went back. I did my master's in global commerce at the University of Virginia, and I went into management consulting from there. So hated it. It sucked. I did it for 6 months. Some might say I'm a quitter, but in some things I would agree. And that's when a couple of the guys I grew up playing golf with, they came to me and they said, hey, we started this company, or one guy started the company. He asked me if I wanted to come on board. And he had pitched this idea to the PGA of America about essentially having an analytics or an intelligence team for Team USA. We had lost a disproportionate amount of Ryder Cups in the past, particularly in Europe, having on paper better teams. And there was this perfect business case. So I started doing that while I was doing some consulting. I quit consulting and went and did a master's in computer science because I thought those skills were a lot more relevant to the type of analytic work that I was doing for the US Ryder Cup team. So I was able to sort of learn as well as apply in that process. And it sort of just kept going from there. We eventually got some basketball clients. We eventually won the President's Cup seal, and we're going on our fourth Ryder Cup into Italy now.
I can't wait to dive into this even deeper, but I'm going to be like, this sounds like the coolest, most fun job ever to like be able to assist and help Team USA find a way to win. So I'm super excited to hear. Here's some information that you're willing to share with us. By no means do we want to share any sort of information that could be detrimental, which I know that you would never do that, but really, really excited to kind of maybe dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. You know, it sounds really exciting, but the majority of my work is coding. So depending on your appetite for that, I mean, the fun part is we do get a present this information to the captain, the vice captains, and often some of the players. And I think one of the most exciting but also challenging parts of that is how do you convey highly complex information to people who have no background in understanding that type of information, right? So we're dealing in simulation, we're dealing in machine learning models, we're dealing in things that the average person has no clue how to understand. And you're going into an athlete who's focused 100% of their time on athletics, right? They're brilliant guys, but it's just not in their normal working vocabulary to have to understand a Monte Carlo simulation or any of these more advanced techniques that we use. So delivering insights and information in a way that a golfer's brain works is something that I've really had to learn up on and understand. You know, how do you know, like, oh, this model takes this in, it uses these advanced techniques, this like a neural net architecture to train and spit this out. That means nothing to probably no ordinary people outside of data scientists. So conveying that information to me is like very much an art. It's taken a lot of iteration, a lot of practice, and that's also been a very fun thing for us to work through.
So like in today's golf world, a lot of golfers, especially in the professional realm, have heard of the, you know, shots gained. Now that's just, you know, kind of feels, now the way that you're talking kind of almost feels dumbed down to just put a very simple positive or negative number on, you know, thousands of shots that are hit throughout a season. Are you using a lot of that shots gained data, or are you diving even deeper to identify some benefits in random places?
That's a good question. So we use some strokes gained data. I think strokes gained is brilliant. You know, Mark Brody, he was working for the international team that the U.S. beat, the U.S. beat this year. Obviously, he is the creator of strokes gained. And what stroke gained does is it beautifully lets you compare one shot to another shot, apples to apples, right? So, for example, in baseball, you know, you have the wins above replacement. You can compare two players who don't play the same position, which used to be a historically difficult thing to do. Now in golf, you can compare the value of a drive to the value of a putt, which for any analytics person is, at the very least, a step towards the holy grail of sports analytics, is we want to be able to quantify and value everything that's out there. So his work, again, was seminal. It was incredible. It was great. But at the same time, strokes gained is a baseline. So it means that every shot that I hit, I'm weighed against other players, not weighed against myself, not weighed against, it is sort of weighed against the course, but there is a differentiation there. So a lot of what we do is maybe one step past that, where we're looking at actual shots, where we're trying to analyze how golfers would perform on courses that they don't typically play. You know, Ryder Cup venues are not courses that are seen on the PGA Tour every week. Sometimes the international courses, actually usually the international courses, are on the DP World Tour schedule. But those are things that we have to consider, is none of our guys that play there, how do we create data? How do we estimate or simulate or project their performance on these venues where really not many of them have played before?
So obviously at any moment, just be like, yeah, probably it's not something I feel comfortable talking about, but are we talking about like length of tee shots? Are we talking about, you know, fairway width? Are we talking about speed of greens, firmness of greens? Are we talking about amounts of water on holes, holes that are water left, right, et cetera? What are we talking about? What type of information?
We're talking about all of it. That's the beauty of it, right? Is that, you know, essentially like we have to build the course, or we have to model the course. We have to project how they would play based on their past performance, their past shot data. I mean, you're getting as granular as individual shots and trying to replicate how a game would look on this new venue.
It's fascinating to even think about. So let's just take a Ryder Cup or something from years ago. Is there information that you can share with us, like how you have identified like strengths or weaknesses of an individual's game from, say, we're here in Minnesota. So if we were to talk about like, say, the 2016 Ryder Cup.
So I think that's a beautiful thing. So you talked about weaknesses or strengths in someone's game. That's probably the most traditional way that everyone looks at it. That is not how we look at it. Like, we don't look at a player as, oh, they hit it far, they'd be a good fit for this course. They putt it good, the greens are, you know, Poana, and they'll probably putt well here. That's looking at it in isolation. The way we look at it is the whole game. So essentially, we are creating a framework where these players with the data are playing thousands of rounds on these golf courses, and we're able to see how they would actually perform based on real shots that they've hit historically. So the idea that, you know, for example, an alternate shot, it's like, oh, I usually hit it in this range, let's say on a par four, or we're playing alternate shot. And you have two guys that's like, well, you know, I'm more commonly on average, I hit it in this range, and he's better from 150 yards to 170 yards. So we should play it where I hit it off the tee and he hits the second shot because he's good in that range. That's like too reductionist. Like, there's so many different tee shots you could have. And if you could actually simulate the other person hitting real shots that they've hit from the different ranges of the dispersion pattern of the tee shot, you can start to get actual numbers and deviations and distributions of what that looks like. So to me, a lot of people, they like close it in. You say, oh, this guy's good for this, this guy's good for that. As you guys know, like, golf is so much more complex than that. If you played a course 1,000 times, 2,000 times, though, even if you didn't hit it that far, or like the makeup of the holes was a little different than you expected, you'd start to see these crazy patterns over time. And that's what we hope to do, is we try to get away from like the heuristics of, you know, this guy's a good putter, this guy's a long driver, this guy's a good wedge player, this guy's a good long driver, and they'll fit together, and get more to like, what if they actually played 1,000 rounds on this golf course? What could possibly happen? And I think that there's, you know, fortunately through the technology, we have the power to do that. But that was a lot of paradigm shift for us from the early years. But I think that this approach is probably the most robust that it could be.
It definitely answers it. Maybe I rephrase the question, I guess, would be like some of the pairings. Like, what are you looking for? Are you trying to mesh those two guys or gals together to then be like, all right, if this person were one person playing alternate shot, for example, like we know that this, you know, this super player, if you will, is going to play this course at X based on the thousands of rounds of simulations that we've ran. how do you identify who's going to be, you know, is there something that you could share with us as to maybe what would be key indicators or key items that would lead to have a good quote unquote super player if you mesh them together?
Yeah. So, it's the easiest one is the ball. Tiger and Phil together. Tiger plays the spinniest ball on tour. Phil played the lowest spin, hardest ball on tour. And obviously Phil had to play Tiger's ball in that pairing. And about, you know, imagine going out playing the exact opposite of the equipment that you're used to. There's implications of that. So, you know, one of the things, maybe not as analytical, but that's a major lesson learned, is that you have to understand the equipment that the other person uses. And if you're going to be paired with someone, how do you evaluate based on that? I think that's a pretty high level obvious one. In terms of the individual pairings, like we're doing exactly what I was describing, is rather than looking at a super player, we see how the players score when they hit each other's shots. We're able to create that type of that framework. And that's what we gauge almost everything off of. We have a couple different models that we use to try to get that as accurate as possible. And we can then simulate out as many matches as possible to say, hey, is this someone that we think would be a good fit for the team based on the model that we built for the course and of them playing on that model.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And so to kind of take it a step further, are you potentially projecting potential opponents, or is it strictly measuring their own game, basically them against the course?
If you really think about it, there's no way, especially in the Ryder Cup, in the President's Cup, tiny bit different, but there's no way to predict who you're going to play, right? So as long as everyone is playing against the same opponent, that would be what the measure would be. And the same opponent, if it's scoring in the course, that is usually the best baseline that we create. So we would essentially make a framework where these guys are playing against a static opponent or a static course, and then you can say, okay, are we gonna how do these guys all line up compared to that baseline? And then, you know, we make these recommendations, for example, for captain's picks or for pairings to the captain. They can take them or leave them. You know, we're just advisors. That's the biggest thing. I mean, I recognize that our work, I will not take credit for any Ryder Cup or President Cup victory. We didn't have to hit a single shot, right? But hopefully there's some small percentage that the decision making or the improvement on the pairing or the people that we took were able to create better outcomes. You know, again, maybe 2-3%. But sometimes that's enough, especially if we're playing a Ryder Cup in Europe, like the one that's coming up here.
So Ken, when you when are you getting involved in the process when you're landing, you know, call your company a gig with President's Cup, Ryder Cup, whatever it may be? Like, when do you start that engagement, right? Like you talked about maybe, you know, some of the people that would be on the team. Are you guys signing contracts? Like, so you got the next Hazeldene coming up, so I assume years in advance. You know, are you guys starting to run models now and try and, you know, project a couple of years out, or when does the process start?
Yes. So occasionally we'll look into something related to like the point system. That's not something that is off the table. I think that the point system could be a definite improvement. I think that there was a circumstance, I think it was either 2016 or 2018, where, so the points are based on dollars. And because of Brexit, the number of points that were awarded in the British Open, if Brexit had not happened, it would have changed the makeup of who made who qualified for the team, right? So there's like non-environmental factors or non-playing factors that they can still influence who makes the team and who doesn't make the team. So probably the point system could be improved a little bit. It still does work relatively well, but there's also a reason why they've gone to 6 captain's picks rather than having 4. And I think before it was 2. So, you know, the more freedom that the captains have, the better that they can choose a team that is a good fit for the specific course and the test at hand. And, you know, if I could have it my way, I'd have 12 picks. Just because, you know, yes, it's good to qualify, but I would like, if I was a captain, to have complete control over who is on the team, who is not on the team. That to me would be pretty compelling. Not something I think anyone will ever do, but
no, I mean, I would tend to agree with you. That would seem like if you're the captain, you might as well pick everybody who's going to be on your team. However, my question where I was, your talk track kind of brought me to was surrounding like, you know, generalizations that are, that people have, like, you know, oh, Kevin Kisner's great at match play. Like he should be on the Ryder Cup team. Like, is there validity to that based on, you know, especially like match play versus stroke play?
Yeah, that is a good question. So in terms of if every tournament, every week was a match play event, I would say, dang, you're probably right. You know, if he's winning all these, but he would also qualify for the team. But there's just such a small sample of match play tournaments. You have the cup events. You have Walker Cup historically, but probably not the same player they were when they were an amateur. And you have the, I guess it's Dell now. In Austin. And so, you know, from 5-10 tournaments, if you want me to say someone's a great match player or not, it's really hard to say. I mean, the one thing is they play the same tournament for, you know, the same golf course for the match play tournament almost every year. Golf course could be a huge component of that. So there's a lot of confounding variables that, you know, it 100% could be that is the case, right? That this person is a great match play player. That to me, from a data perspective, is not enough evidence to say, hey, like he's a must take, especially if all the other stats don't line up, if all the projections are not adding up, making or suggesting that he'd be a good fit for the course. That is also, you know, that is something that I would expect the captain or the vice captains to consider as well. You know, those guys, they know golf better than I ever will. They know the other guys on the team. They know what professional golf life is like a lot better than I ever will. And they can say, hey, like, you know what? This guy is an absolute stick in match play. I've seen it myself. There's just something else in him that comes out, and I want him on the team because of that. And I'm never going to push back against that. You know, they are truly the expert in that area. I mean, I think Ian Poulter is a good example of that. Like, Ian Poulter's career has been going, yeah, not as good as it used to be. But, you know, he still made the Ryder Cup in Wisconsin. You know, he still is feared as a threat. Maybe there's like some psychological advantage you have as well there. And those are things, as of right now, I cannot quantify.
Do you think that on the, I know, you know, the Europeans were really good for a while, really before you guys, you know, stepped in and started consulting. And I think one of the impetuses of, you know, that consulting work was the success that the Europeans have been having over us. Do you think they were intuitively doing some of these things? Like what made Europe so formidable for all those years?
So I think yes, 100%. Intuitively, they were doing some things. Culturally, they had a lot of different things that they maybe they lucked into. Maybe it was good design. So usually you see Spanish guys play together. You see, you know, people from England play together. And you might say, oh, that's breaking up the group. That's probably not optimal. But systematically, if you know who you're playing with, there's a massive advantage to that. If you're cultivating those relationships far out, there's also an advantage to that. And the Europeans were the ones to first hire an analytics team. So they hired one, and then that was part of our business case as well. It's like, if they're doing it, they're just going to get better. We got to come in and sort of hash this out. I will also say the golf that they play is a little bit more familiar to them. So if you think about it, a lot of the European Ryder Cup venues are DP World Tour stops. So a lot of those guys have seen those courses. A lot of the US guys don't really go over there to check them out. But those are sort of the nuances that, or, you know, the many added up nuances that make the Europeans successful. It's kind of this craftiness, this wiliness. And I think analytics in part, you know, did play a larger role in that in the last 5 years. And it's nice that we have the tools and capabilities now on the US side to be able to counter that, to be able to create some strategies to maximize our own performance. I think something that we really focus on is we want to make the US team or give advice to the US team to make us as good as possible. And we focus less and less on, okay, what can we do to disrupt the Europeans? Because with LIV, it seems like they're kind of doing a good job of that themselves.
Ken, when you, like you're talking about the courses a little bit. So I guess one of the questions, assume that there's a course like literally none of these guys have played. When you're doing the analytics or models, whatever you're doing on this, like my mind immediately kind of went to the Decade Golf, right? Like if I had logged 100 rounds to my Decade Golf app and I showed up to a random course, it would say, you need to hit driver on 1, 3 wood on 2, right? You're going to have these numbers in because you're really good with these, clubs. Is that the type of stuff that you guys have in those models? Like you could tell the USA, hey, if there are 5 courses over here in Europe, this is the one that the team would play the best on based on the 12 players that you have? Or like, how do you factor in those types of things, like with a golf course and the types of players?
Well, so to be honest, the golf course, the specific venue, that's settled way out, way above our pay grade. Like, that's based on politics, the courses they want to showcase, pay money, whatever that might be. So a lot of it is us adapting to the course. And the best way to adapt to a course is to choose a team that would be a good fit for the course. So that's generally the first focus is, hey, how do we find the best players for the individual course at hand? And then we go on to say, okay, with these players who we think are going to be great for this golf course, or with whoever qualifies or whatever it might be, how do we create the best scenarios for us to win with pairings across the different types of formats and the sessions? And it becomes a very, very large math problem, as I like to say.
You're kind of building everything around the golf course, right? That's super interesting. How much of an impact does the actual course fit play? I mean, I know we're probably getting into proprietary model stuff here, but is it super important, or is it kind of important? Like, if to some extent, if a guy's really good, he's really good. Is it more heavily weighted on guys not being a course fit versus they would play that course really, really well? Like, how much do you share there?
Let me put this. I think the most important thing is to have the best players in the U.S. at the event, right? A lot of people talk about current form. I think current form is fairly fickle. I would rather have a guy who over the course of a year played really well rather than over the course of 3 weeks is playing really well. To me, that's something that is really relevant. In terms of the venue, I would rather have, again, a guy who's really freaking good, probably would qualify for the team over someone who is a perfect fit for the venue, but is just not as good a golfer or is maybe in form for the course or whatever that might be. So, I would ask you, you look at some of the venues they played, you look at, for example, Hazeltine versus Le Golf National, those two courses, I don't think could have been more different if I could possibly draw them up. And so, if I was to, I played both of those courses. And Le Golf National is just, in my opinion, not a good golf course. I cannot stand. I hope that the French don't get wind of this. But to me, that was that, again, that's not an excuse or anything. It's just that there's a specific type of golfer that plays well there, and it's Justin Rose.
Yeah.
it's as simple as that. You hit it on a freaking string. Don't have to putt that good. The greens are all flat. They're
make
small, but they're flat,
and you win.
Yeah, exactly. And
go ahead, Ken. Sorry.
No, that was all I got.
Oh, so I was. My question was going to be, again, we might be a little bit partial because we're in Minnesota, but it's going. The Ryder Cup is going back to Hazeltine. Is there a big reason regarding when I think about choosing courses, the spectacle that these events have morphed into, and the sheer volume of people that, and parking space and all of those kinds of things have to play into account, but just how well the U.S. played at Hazeltine, that has to come into it. I have to imagine that played into the decision-making process. Now, does some models change because this is now the second time around, or is it kind of hey, don't change what worked last time?
Yeah, I mean, more data is always good, right? And we've learned a lot. Hopefully we've learned a lot since 2016, right? That's a pretty important thing for us. So, I mean, I would imagine our analysis would be substantially different. We'd also have very different players, I would expect, by the time the event is there. I have no clue about the actual process for choosing the venue. I think that I would imagine Hazeltine wanted another Ryder Cup, and they lobbied for it, and they won a contract. That's my guess how it would play out. I would say that buy some property out there, rent it out, because when we were Whistling Straits, across the street, the guy who rented out his lawn as a parking lot, RV spot, whatever it is, he probably cleared like $200,000 in a week. So, you know, get a real estate deal now if there's any land remotely around Hazeltine.
There's plenty of land around here.
I'm less than 10 minutes from Hazeltine. What if we like all slept in my garage and we like shuttled people?
Well, I have a house too. I don't need to sleep in your garage.
We're here once a week.
Yeah, bunk up, rent out a house. I mean, rent out your yard. People pull up with trailers, all this crazy. I mean, it was grotesque how much this one like random farmer across the street made. But pretty interesting stuff.
Thoughts on LIV, what that's going to do to the Europeans with the upcoming Ryder Cup. I think the outlook is looking pretty good for the Americans on paper. That's not always gone well for us. Yeah, knock on wood.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the Europeans that went to LIV, kind of a lot of them were later in their career in terms of playing. I don't know how much the European team lost. In terms of long-term leadership, I think that there was a whole hierarchy, a whole pipeline of guys that were going to captain that team that are now either off the table or it's kind of opaque about what the future looks like for them. So this immediate year, I can't really say how much it would impact. I think long-term, absolutely, the Europeans are going to be hurting for all of the structure and the culture that they've created. You know, a lot of those big guys, Sergio, Lee Westwood, Henrik Stenson, a lot of these guys who played a lot of events. Oh, Ian Poulter. They're just not going to be there. And, you know, from an analytics perspective, that's not something we quantify. From just understanding how these team events work or how important leadership is in any organization, I 100% feel and recognize that is a big deal, in my opinion.
Yeah. And another question for you is, I don't know how much you can share about this, but you get to go. I believe there was a Golf Digest article about you guys. Like, it said in there that you're in the team room. So I know you're definitely like a very close part of the week. What have been some of the weeks like for you? Like, I mean, first of all, as like your buddy growing up, like that's got to be so cool. Like, there's got to be the golf fan in you, part of you that's like, you know, kind of pinching yourself a little bit, going like, this is pretty cool. But
yeah, you know, it is pretty cool, but in some sense, it's business as usual, right? I mean, the captains, the players, like, they're our clients. We're just trying to do the best job for them as possible. I mean, they're the best, you know, golfers in the world, the best Ryder Cup captains in the world. I would hope that we're some of the best, like, golf analysts in the world, and that's what we're being evaluated on in that moment. So, you know, it is, like, in those settings, that's how we view it. It's like, this is a professional thing. I've never asked for a photograph, an autograph. I have an issue with adults asking for autographs anyway.
Period. It's the worst. Yeah. Genuinely the worst.
but you know, like, that's sort of how I look at it. I mean, I think about this because I really do. I think about how I feel if I go to, like, a data science convention. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to be one of those guys that's, like, you know, that wants their attention, whatever it might be. Like, they're just other people. And the more time you spend around these guys, you realize they're, like, they're just like any other people. They want, it's not that they want to be left alone, but they just want to be treated like anyone else. To that point, though, being inside the ropes is one of the wildest things of all time. You get heckled. I signed a couple autographs because people just thought I was like Colin Morikawa's cousin. Like, it gets pretty intense. Like, and last year, one person recognized me from like the data stuff I did on YouTube, and that was the greatest moment for me.
You've got
one of us out there. Just
I checked out your YouTube. It's like almost 300,000 subscribers, like a bunch of stuff on data science. It looks pretty sweet, man.
It's fun, you know. I mean, content's a lot of It's good. I recommend everyone do it because, you know, when you do content, you gotta control the platform. You gotta tell your story. You gotta share your experiences, rather than letting anyone else create those for you. So that's sort of, to me, like, if you're not doing it and telling these stories, either nobody will, or someone else will do it, and you don't know how good a job they're gonna do.
So you guys are working primarily in golf, but you said you also have some basketball contracts. Is that right?
Yeah. So we did a little work for one NBA team. We're doing some stuff with USA Basketball now. So, you know, ideally, I think we'd love to work across a lot of team sports, working for USA. That'd be really neat. If we could get some sort of system down for Olympics, World Cups, those types of things. I'm kind of leaving the door open for that in the future, but right now it's just golf and basketball and totally different games. I mean, golf is my wheelhouse. Basketball, I think Andy in high school might have seen me take like a jump shot and just walked out of the gym in disgust. So
no.
I know. I when it comes out of my hand, I'm like, I really should. I should stick to golf.
No, but, I mean, you're underrated athleticism.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Overrated mathleticism, though.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a directed question in like finding way, like, what are some other team sports, like areas that, you know, that you guys, as a way, like to quote unquote pitch, no pun intended regarding baseball, but areas that.
Well, Ken and I have been talking about that.
Yeah.
With one of our buddies.
Yeah. I mean, there's opportunities for all of this. I mean, I think something really important is subject area expertise. And fortunately, you know, the whole team, you know, Jason, who started the company, he's a single digit. Danny, who is another big member, he played at Georgetown. Larry Haymont, who's another big member of the team, he played at Cornell. I mean, we're all, like, three of the four of us play Division I golf. We have that foundation. Larry is, like, a basketball savant in terms of the history and those types of things. So he works really well that project. I think working in other sports, if, you know, we're collaborating or partnering with someone that has that domain knowledge, it's pretty easy to apply the analytics knowledge and to create synergy there. We really do two types of projects. We either do one where we come in and we run the analytics and we say, hey, like, we're going to do the coding, we're going to do the projects, we'll give you the outcomes. We also do things where we go in and essentially help build research infrastructure, help build a data team for an organization that potentially doesn't have one. So let's say you're a new hockey team, the Kraken, who actually have a very good data team. Let's say they didn't. We'd come in and say, okay, who should you hire? What critical infrastructure do you need? What are the first projects you should be doing? Let's get you up to speed as quick as possible. So there's sort of two main lines of business for us. And I would imagine a lot of US sports, because of lack of funding, really don't have any of that critical infrastructure. So it's, you know, I'm not like a patriot by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that there's an opportunity to do some really cool stuff with elite level athletes, some of the best in the world, and help them just get maybe a little bit more of an edge.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's like really interesting, Ken, is obviously, you know, you've been a golfer and you've played, and you can kind of speak that language probably to guys. I know one of our really good buddies from high school, Danny Holtman, is working in the front office for the Cubs right now. Well, he's working for the team, and his job is to really translate the analytic kind of to the players, you know, in player speak, because I think it's, you know, there's definitely some gaps there, right, between some of the data science and like what a player feels or understands. I know you probably can't get into specifics about, you know, specific relationships with players, but can you talk a little bit about like your experience, you know, working with players or helping them with things that you see in the data with respect to their game?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that maybe this is just a good business practice, but throwing a spreadsheet at a player is probably never a good idea or any end user. I mean, thinking about what the individual player wants, what the individual, let's call them like a stakeholder, wants is probably the most important thing. Golfers want to improve their golf, or they want to get the best outcomes they can out of a pairing or whatever that might be. And our goal is to say, hey, like, this is what we think you need to do to get there. So the advice or the recommendation always has to be tied to the specific outcome. You know, maybe some players, it's like, hey, we want to make more money. That's probably pretty important. Well, if you, you know, lowered your scoring average by half a shot over this course of this year, you could make, you know, $600,000 more. That might be compelling, right? You know, the other side of that is just really getting down and trying to explain these complex models and complex things in ways that the players will understand. Like, I don't expect anyone, again, to like understand what a Monte Carlo simulation is. Like, I don't expect you guys to understand what a Monte Carlo simulation is.
Don't, because we don't.
Well, so, but I mean, that goes double for any of the players. Like, that is not their job. It is our job to translate what that means. I mean, you know, essentially it's like, oh, you know, we're going to create a framework where you're, you know, playing the same shots over and over again, or like variation of the shots, and you get some sort of outcome. To me, those types of things, like, you can't just give them advice. They won't be like, oh, well, you know, a lot of times, like, what do you know? You've never hit a shot on the PGA Tour, and you're 100% right. So I have to have some substantiation and say, okay, well, like, this is why there's validity to this. This is why there's credibility. But it's just picking and choosing the information that is going to be the most effective and understandable to any given client or end user. So nothing super insightful, mainly just like what a good business practice would be with an end user. It's just, in our case, the end user are usually professional golfers or captains or someone related to coaches or management team at professional sports organizations.
We started, before we started recording, we kind of briefly touched on this, and I don't know, you might just be like, has no application, but technology is ever changing, right? And so the advent of some newer technology, whether it's ChatGPT or any of these other types of tools, is there anything there that you could use to help your models expeditiously? Or, you know, is there things that you could use like that could either help your models or potentially challenge your models, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, every player has TrackMan, FlightScope, or Foresight, the launch monitors.
Yep.
I don't think I know any player outside of maybe Matt Fitzpatrick that actually captures that data and uses it ever again. If every player just captured that data and saved it, you could do some incredible stuff with the data, but most of them just forget about it. They use it in the moment. They're just using it as a diagnostic. So those tools, I mean, they're one of the most valuable innovations ever in the sport, and the data from them, in my personal opinion, is still being underutilized. I mean, in this game, in analytics in general, data is the gold. The more data, the models don't really change that much, but if you have more data and more interesting data, you can get more interesting and valuable insights. I will say a small caveat. I am an analytics guy, but analytics also ruined my golf game. I went down the TrackMan rabbit hole. I was trying to hit numbers instead of trying to hit shots. And that's what really completely undid my golf. I had to quit golf after I turned professional for like 2 years. I didn't touch a glove. And then I eventually crawled back. But, you know, finding that balance is really important. I would imagine, although I wasn't that good, but that same type of thing, like chasing numbers, can also hurt players. And a lot of the time you want to have some sort of buffer between yourself and the players. Like, it could be the caddy or the agents looking at the numbers and just giving the right information. It doesn't have to be the individual players that are getting the benefit of this. I'm not saying that professional golfers are as fragile as I was, or just like, you know, lack the mental fortitude that I appeared to not have. But it's important to think, like, what are the implications of what I'm telling this person? Like, if I told Andy, if I was like, hey, you know, actually, like, you think you're a good driver, but you're like kind of not, you know,
yeah.
You hit it far, but your miss pattern is like really skewed this direction or whatever it might be. Next time you get up and tee up a ball, like, what are you going to think? All right. So there's a lot of sort of subtleties that, like, hey, we have to be careful of some of this stuff. I mean,
yeah, there's a thinking thing. And then I also think, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, Ken, but like, you know, sometimes there are things that, like, the data obviously can't account for. And I know, like, Danny gave me a really interesting example about a guy that, like, they saw in the analytics that, you know, he his splitter was, like, way underutilized. But what they didn't know is that every time he threw his splitter, he lost the feel for his two-seam fastball, which was his best pitch. And so, you know, it's just an example of, like, kind of some nuance to that where, like, yes, the data was screaming, like, throw more splitters. But actually, whenever he threw more splitters, it, you know, he lost the feel of that other pitch. Can you talk a little bit about, like, where the data isn't perfect? Or, you know, I don't know if you consider yourself a data purist, but we're sort of seeing this tension in sports more and more with analytics. And certainly, like, you know, I think some of the analytics in football say to go for two every time, right? But, like, you know, I don't know the teams necessarily do that. Talk to us a little bit about that kind of relationship.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Data quality, in my opinion, is one of the most important things. And I was actually at the PGA Tour. I was talking with the Shot Leaking team. That's where we get all of our data from recently. And they're doing some really impressive stuff. I mean, the stuff that we have now, it's good, but they're really working hard to improve the quality. I mean, something that we still, that currently isn't where it could be is that a lot of the shots, we don't necessarily have direction, right? So we don't have the spin numbers for all the shots on tour. You just have where it starts and where it ends. Same with putts. You don't have the break for the most part. You don't have a lot of nuance about those things. So for example, the strokes gained stuff that you look at when it's like, oh, he has a 28% chance to make this putt on TV. That's not for that player. That's just overall. The average golfer has a 28% chance. So I think to me, that's one of the biggest things is, okay, you know, can we get more shot specific? Can we get more player specific as we continue to improve the quality of the data and the quality of the models, and also getting more data? You know, the data we use from ShotLink, we have every shot hit by every player since I think it's 2003. That's still not that many shots if you're thinking about what big data means now. So if I had twice the amount of data, if I had 5 times, 10 times the amount of data, the amount of different methodologies, the amount of different tools I could use at my disposal is a lot greater. So those are two sort of areas where I think that there's a lot of improvement to be made. But to your point, there's a lot of times where captains or people, they'll see stuff that we don't or that the models could not possibly quantify. And, you know, that's part of our job is that, like, we don't see the whole picture. We see some of the picture. We try to, you know, it's like, it's going to sound really nerdy, but if you ever played like a real-time strategy game, like there's like StarCraft, WarCraft, whatever it is, you like go and you explore a map. And when you discover parts of the map, it goes from being black to like being clear and you can at least see what's there. That's sort of what our job is to do is we're trying to clear some of the map so the captains can see what's there and then they can go in and make a better informed decision about that. They still get to choose what to do. They still get to do all these other things, but we just help them have a better understanding of everything that's out there so that they can make the best and most well-informed decisions possible.
Ken, I have two last questions. The first is, what do the best golfers that you see analytics-wise do? Is it they're like best off the tee or putting or chipping? That would be my first question. If like you see that within your models, like, What are the best golfers? What are they the best at analytically?
Yeah. So, I mean, our models are most relevant for the specific Ryder Cup venues, but overall, the best golfers drive it and hit it really good. I mean, like their iron game and their, you know, like their strokes gained tee to green is great. In putting, there's a ton of variation week to week. Like even a bad putter can have a great week putting. And if they're a good ball striker, the week that they have where they're a good putter also is when they win. So if I could have any strengths in any categories, it'd be driving and approach. And like my putting and short game, as a professional golfer, I'd be like, screw it. I'm going to have a week where it's happens to be good and I'm going to win that week. That's like the most consistent, right? You're not going to miss cuts if you're hitting it good. Not super rocket science, but I think it's also very different for amateur golfers. I think it's inverse for amateur golfers. Like you can pick up the most strokes around the greens as amateur golfers. Like even me, like I hit it great 2 weeks ago and I bladed like 5 wedge shots, right? And it's like, well, If I didn't do that, I would have, instead of shooting like four over, I probably would have shot like 200. So it's like, you know, there's some like obvious big misses you want to avoid as an amateur that these professionals don't have. You don't see very frequently the best players in the world like flubbing chips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The best players in the world get the ball. They're good at getting the ball closer to the hole than they are, you know, maybe chipping or putting. And then the second would be for amateurs. This is like what you talked about when we first started. How do you, how could somebody start trying to get kind of data or analytics on their game, right? Like, we're probably not going to be a Matt Fitzpatrick tracking every single shot distance, right? And I'm probably not going to have a Excel spreadsheet like you did when you first started, and now you are where you are, which is awesome. But like, what could you track? You know, there's a lot of different apps out there. What's kind of like a nice data set that could be like, hey, I really need to work on my long irons, or hey, I need to work on putting. Like, what could you do as kind of a amateur golfer that plays 20, 30 rounds a year?
I mean, any app that you use is probably better than no app. I more recently, I was using, I think, My Round Pro. I like that one a good bit. I didn't even talk about my post-pro career. I played college golf. I mean, Division I golf at the club level during my computer science master's degree. And I started collecting some stats there again. I actually won my first ever tournament at the club golf level, so kind of a big flex. But
yeah, you won a tournament, man. You're a winner.
But yeah, I mean, my biggest advice for anyone trying to get better is first to just start collecting the data. Just collecting data is 60% of the battle, because you're aware of it, right? If you're constantly cataloging your shots, you're going to start to see patterns in what you're doing to begin with. It's just a natural thing that happens. For example, if I want to lose weight, the first step would be I'd weigh myself every day, and then I'd be aware of my weight. Like, it's just that awareness creates massive changes in what anyone does. The second thing is to actually act on the data. So I think I used this stat with you guys a while ago, but when prescriptions are filled, I think like once you get a prescription from the doctor, maybe 60% of people will actually fill the prescription, and then 20% or something like that. These are relatively made up stats, but based on truth, will actually take the prescription that they're prescribed. And it's the same thing with golf. Is if you're like, wow, I need to work on my putting, but I freaking hate just grinding on the putting greens, like, you're not going to get better putting, right? If you recognize that part of your game and are willing to act on it, you'll actually get better. And the third part of that is how you practice and how you get better is really important as well. If you're just sitting there grinding, hitting putts, but you know your putting stroke is super out to in, the ball's not rolling out of the gate, there's something you have to do to correct that before you start hitting those putts. So just identifying sort of those three areas of collection, like focusing on what you need to, and doing the practice correctly, I think everyone would get better at golf. And there's only a little bit of stats that are needed, just more dedication to the craft and to the pursuit of getting better. Because I'm definitely guilty of literally all of those things, not thinking about it, not wanting to do it, and grinding on the exact like ingraining terrible swing flaws that I'm only finally fixing after, you know, 20 years.
Hey, Ken, any tips for golfers? So a lot of our audience are, you know, play in different events and have partners. And we do a couple things at our club, Windsong, every year, where we have like inner club 12 on 12. Any hot tips for Tony, who's our team captain, on pairings? Like, any general ideas there or things to follow?
Yeah. So how much time you got? I'm just kidding. Well, a big one.
You without mining all the data. Do all of our data and put it in your model. You can spit out Tony's team.
Yeah. Well, so I have this like code right here that we can run. And I think a big thing for me is, you know, if you think about it from a finance perspective, you have two assets that are completely uncorrelated, and if you put them in a portfolio, you diversify a little bit. So don't be scared to put two highly volatile people together, because there is some form of diversification, especially if they're playing best ball. Alternate shot, that's a tough one. Just get guys that like each other. Like, that's
That's awesome. Yeah, it's super interesting on the volatility piece. Cool. Any other questions, Jordan? Tony?
No, I mean, this has just been a fascinating conversation, and I think, you know, we're well over what we typically record for, and I think that's just a testament because it's been such a fun and engaging conversation with you, Ken. So I know for a fact, like, I'm going to get off of this call and be like, man, I wish I asked him these three questions. And no.
Well, the good news is we can have you back on if you'll come. I'd love to make this somewhat as regular as your schedule permits to keep chatting. I think this is a fascinating conversation. Definitely a layer of the podcast that we want to go into sharing more on. So,
yeah, for sure. I had a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been great. Seriously, thank you so much, Ken.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you guys again. This is a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully
bring some of that Hawaii sun here to Minnesota for us. Yeah, man. We're ready to start golfing.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. That's that might be a little bit too much for my models to handle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, man. Thank you very much, man. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you guys.